morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. On today's call, we have John Porwood, Chief Investment Strategist, and Investment Directors Greg Hudleski, Jeffrey Tangus, and Richard Chauvin. And Richard will be the moderator today.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. To start off, I wanted to make a few comments about the employment situation and then ask John Portwood to make further comments on the economy. We saw in June a rather large non-farm jobs increase, well above the expectations of all the forecasters who forecast such items. It was up 222,000 jobs in June, yet the unemployment rate picked up to 4.4%, which of course is still an historically very low number. Yet in spite of those strong employment results, we're still seeing wage growth rather sluggish, up only 0.2% in June, and on a year-over-year basis, wages have only grown at 2.5%. This is pretty unprecedented contrast in employment statistics. So why is this happening? Is it demographics? Is it the globalization of labor? Is it the type of jobs that are being filled, the use of temporary labor or part-time employment? John Portwood, what do you see going on in the economy here with regard to employment in other areas?
Well, you know, one of the, I guess, a general answer to your question on unemployment and wages is, you know, like all of the above. It's really been an interesting situation. The models that economists have used in the past have not worked for years, and we've talked about that quite a bit, the fact that we have a 2% plus or minus economy, and everybody continually expects, well, they don't anymore, but you should say, think about an immediate breakout or something to a 3% trend growth that we all thought was, excuse me, normal for a long period of time, but unfortunately, that's not the case. We got some interesting statistics. The other day, looking at the unemployment rate, the last time the unemployment rate was at this level, a little over 4%, average hourly earnings were growing at a much faster rate and were certainly accelerating, but they're not this time. And, you know, Richard, you mentioned some of the reasons why. We got low productivity growth. We got low nominal GDP growth. We've talked about that before. The economy just simply isn't growing very fast. And although corporations are doing reasonably well in terms of revenue growth, it's not particularly exciting. And so they look at revenue growth and they look at prospects going forward, and they're reluctant to really pay up a lot for labor. And, you know, the hires, or they're hiring more people, but they're simply not paying them very much. And so, you know, average hourly earnings are simply not accelerating as you might expect. And there's no immediate you know, reason, I guess, or no immediate factors to expect that's not going to continue for a while. If you go back and look at the rate of wage gains in 2009, it's something like 1.1% annualized. I mean, that's pretty low from the recession bottom. If you go back to 2000 and look at some inflation-adjusted numbers, you're looking at median income being maybe just slightly above the inflation rate for, you know, the past, 16, 17 years. So, you know, that kind of progress is really not enough in the economy and wage growth and so forth to expect, you know, a lot of consumer spending to be going on, or to expect that the normal borrowing, lending, and spending cycle could be regenerated anytime soon. And you look at the last quarter, for example, in terms of consumer spending, there was an upward revision recently that jumped the headline real GDP number to 1.4%. I'm sorry, not the latest quarter, beg your pardon, the first quarter. Jumped it up a little bit to about 1.4%, and the largest upward revision was in consumer spending for healthcare and insurance. So when people begin to break down what people are spending their money on, it's really not for, let's call it discretionary, I guess. Somebody said discretionary lifestyle goods. it's more for things they just have to spend money on, like healthcare and insurance and so forth and so on. So, you know, it doesn't look like that situation is going to change anytime soon. Inflation is low, and you, in fact, it's low globally. Saw a number the other day that suggested the G20, you know, the G20 just had a meeting. Trump was there recently in Europe. If you average all those G20 countries together, you get an inflation rate of around 2%, and it was something like 3.4 about 4 years ago. So inflation is falling worldwide. You also look at the consumer situation and the economic situation in the large countries, particularly in Europe, and you get a similar situation. It's just a very moderate growth atmosphere with no real acceleration in earnings, and I guess in the near term, unless something unusual happens, there isn't any real prospect for that to change anytime soon. This seems to be a broken record. We've been on this subject, I guess, for a long time, month by month, and nothing has really changed. But, you know, other than the details, you know, that's kind of the world that we're still in.
So, John, it sounds like anytime we see any kind of pickup in economic growth or consumer spending, you would say it's probably temporary. We're going to go back to this norm based on the facts that you just mentioned.
That would seem to be a pretty good guess that, you know, we're in a 2% plus or minus trend world, and any significant deviation from that, you know, maybe in the future sometime, but there's certainly not anything like that on the immediate horizon. Fortunately, you know, we don't see anything out there that screams recession, so we seem to be okay on that score.
That's certainly positive. Thank you very much, John. I'm going to turn to Jeff Tangus now. Jeff, we've heard for some time, given that the U.S. economic cycle and monetary cycle was sort of ahead of the rest of the world, that we would have a strengthening dollar versus the rest of the world, but I don't know that that's really been the case lately. What's been going on with the dollar, and what effects have you seen from this trend that wasn't really anticipated, I don't think?
Well, we've talked about in meetings past how the it was dubbed King Dollar because the dollar had been very strong for a long time, primarily because the U.S. economy, as you say, was leading the rest of the world out of the Great Recession back in 2008, 2009, 2010. And so we've talked off and on about the dollar, but I think it's important to point out that when you're investing internationally, there are lots of opportunities, but that comes along with additional risk. And one of those risks and opportunities, both actually, is currency fluctuation. Now, you can invest in different ways. Sometimes you can where you hedge away all the currency risk, and sometimes you accept that currency risk as part of your investing. Last month, listeners may remember, we talked about Brazil, and that was one of the examples for what can go wrong in international investing. We just, as a reminder, Brazil ran into some pretty significant political problems, which led international investors to flee their markets basically out of uncertainty, and their currency collapsed versus most of the other currencies around the world. Well, that's obviously a bad thing if you're either in or outside of Brazil, because that was a big negative return. So what we thought we'd do this month is talk a little bit about the currency aspect of international investing. And the best way to do that is just to talk about real returns. Last month and in this month, we'll talk about how some of the major indices have done around the world. To give you just a snapshot here, the FTSE, which is basically based off of the pound in Britain, so far for this year is up about 2.75% in pound terms, but in dollar terms, it's up about 7%. So that means you made 2.75% in the local stock market, and the balance of that 7% was basically a currency fluctuation to your benefit because the dollar weakened. Now, it's even more pronounced when you get into the European economies like the CAC 40, which is the French market. In local terms, it was up about 6%, but in dollar terms, it was up about 15. So there you go. You've got about 9 percentage points of gain in currency changes. So that was an example where being out of the dollar and investing internationally actually helped you. The emerging markets can even be more pronounced. So the reason is, okay, the question I think is, why has the dollar been weak lately? And the simple answer is, for a long time, our economy was stronger than everybody else, and our interest rates were anticipated to go up more so while everybody else was going down. Well, the European economy is improving, and so now the rest of the world is saying maybe it's time to focus more on economies outside of the U.S., moving money out of the dollar and into other currencies, primarily the euro at this point. So it's something that ebbs and flows. It's not necessarily a good or bad thing. It's just something you have to be aware of when investing internationally. So as the European economy improves, their central bank is talking more and more about not being stimulative, about allowing rates to rise, and as that happens, the European currency, the euro, strengthens against the dollar. So those are aspects that we have to keep in mind. And John Portwood, of course, who has a lot of experience in following the markets internationally, has a lot of experience there and some comments I'd like him to add to this conversation.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. If you look back over many decades and compare the returns on international investments to domestic investments, you know, U.S. investments, you find that the return differential that exists from time to time in terms of international over domestic is largely determined by currency fluctuations. So, as Jeff mentioned, it's a pretty important factor in looking at returns over a long period of time. Now, you know, if you exclude the currency fluctuations, growth rates generally in Europe and the U.S. are pretty similar. I mean, they're not the same among individual companies, of course. I mean, individual companies and individual sectors and regions are going to do better or worse. But just in a general sense, the currency effect is really, really big. And as Jeff just mentioned, sometimes it really works in your favor. Sometimes it's not quite as favorable, and that doesn't mean you don't want to invest internationally, but you need to really understand what's happening from time to time. And, Jeff, it was a good thing for you to bring that up today. It's a pretty interesting thought.
Thanks to both of you. I'm going to turn now to Greg and talk about a general wrap-up of the stock market and which sectors and investment styles did well or poorly during June. Greg?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, equities turned in another positive month of returns in June, so the Dow was up about almost 2%. And kind of in a reversal, the trend that we've seen during the first half of the year where large cap issues underperformed the trend of large cap issues outperforming the smaller cap issues, which was a reversal from last year's trend. We actually saw that go back into that trend of last year where the S&P was only up about 0.6% for the month. The mid-cap index 400 was up 1.6%, and the S&P 600 small cap index actually returned 3%. So that was more of a mirror image of late December last year. For the first time in a while, looking at growth versus value, we actually saw the growth index underperforming the value index. Year to date, growth is up 13%, while value stocks have kind of struggled behind growth, returning only about 5% year to date. But for the month of June, growth was down actually 0.4%, while value returned 2% positively. So is this a reversal? It's difficult to say at this point, but that's certainly something that we're going to keep looking at. In terms of sectors, the best sector was financials, returning over 6%, and for the month, followed by healthcare up 4.6%, and lastly, real estate was up 1.9%. The worst performing sectors were telecom, which was down a negative 2.9%, and that was followed by technology and utilities, which were both down exactly 2.7% for the month. Turning to international markets, most equity markets continue to perform positively, though not as strong as they have over the past few months. Again, more likely due to currency, as we just talked about. The S&P Developed Markets Index was up 0.2%. Emerging Markets Index was up about 1%, and the Frontier Markets, which are the tiny, tiny markets that, you know, aren't even quite in emerging market stage, were down 0.4%. Volatility for the month was up about 7% during the month, but it still remains relatively low if you compare it to prior months. Looking ahead at earnings, we start to receive second quarter earnings announcements over the next several weeks. As it stands right now, the S&P 500 is expected to report about 6.5% earnings growth for the second quarter. So far, only 23 companies have reported so far. It'll be interesting to see, though, what kind of guidance that companies are giving for the second half of the year. After the first quarter earnings reports, many companies were steering earnings estimates downward. Of the companies that have reported, by far the most reasons cited are concerns about a strong dollar impacting earnings and revenues. And just to wrap up, again, looking at valuation, you know, that's something we've been talking about for years now. The forward 12-month PE ratio is still relatively high to historical standards. Right now, looking at a forward PE 12 months out, we're at about 17 times earnings. This is above the 5-year average of just over 15 and also above the 10-year average of 14. So it'll be interesting to see if those downward revisions in earnings from the end of the first quarter manifest themselves in the earnings for the second quarter. And that's what I have, Richard.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much for that wrap-up. I'm going to come back to Jeff again to talk about the bond market, the Federal Reserve, and such matters. Jeff, I understand there was a real change in sentiment among bond investors in June. So tell us about that.
Well, that's exactly right, Richard. As I mentioned before, things have been improving outside our borders considerably, primarily in Europe, but really all around the globe. So central bankers around the world have been moving towards a more restrictive, higher interest rate policy. And so even in the U.S. here, recently we've had some good employment numbers that came out and pushed rates a little bit higher. We've had inflation expectations, while still very subdued, moving a little bit higher. It finally broke a trend towards lower inflation expectations. So things here in the U.S. and around the world have been moving towards a higher interest rate, stronger economy scenario. In the course of all that, we've seen our government 10-year move higher in yield. We had gotten down to, I think, somewhere around 2.15%. I think last week or so we hit 2.39%. So while that's still low in the grand scheme of things, rates have moved up, and some of the technicians who follow interest rates would tell you that it's very close to making some significant technical moves higher. There are even some analysts out there who think that rates could move higher from here, something closer to 3% before the end of the year. We're not exactly in that camp yet. We need to see more evidence. But clearly, if the Trump administration is able to get some agenda items accomplished through either health care or tax reform or both, that's good for the economy, and that means that rates are likely to drift higher. The Federal Reserve has raised twice so far this year, and right now it's about 50-50 probability, that the Fed raises one more time before the end of the year, probably in the December meeting if they do it. It may slip into January But at this point, they've raised about 50 basis points, and the Fed would like to get in another third increase before the end of the year, if the economy allows it, if the economic numbers are strong enough. So we'll have to wait and see here, but with inflation expectations moving higher, the economy seeming to do a little bit better, unemployment numbers showing some decent performance, there certainly is a bias here towards higher rates. How much higher is yet to be seen, but we are, you know, we are positioned for rates to move higher, so that is our expectation, but it remains to be seen exactly how much higher.
Very good. Thank you, Jeff. And you briefly mentioned the Trump administration agenda there, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that for a minute. We've talked about this before to some degree, but out there, maybe in the future months of this year into next year, we believe that there's a possibility of a tax reform plan that may be stated as revenue neutral, but would actually have some stimulative pro-growth tax cut in it. And that is not something you're going to hear much about, at least in the near future, but we think you'll hear more about it later. I'm going to explain that a little bit, how that could work, because this is not something I've read about in many places, but there's an interesting possibility here that I want to talk about. So in the weeks ahead, there's going to be a budget resolution that comes to the floor in Congress, and with it comes a what's called a reconciliation instruction, which basically sets the rules for what a tax reform package must have in it and how it must be handled. The reconciliation instruction, we believe, will be designed to allow for a tax reform package to pass with a simple majority of 51 votes rather than the 60 votes, which, of course, would be much higher to achieve given the narrow Senate majority that's in place today. With that threshold of 51 votes, there's going to be some strict limits imposed on what can be considered in this budget resolution. So, we think the most likely course that Congress will choose is what is, in quotes, revenue-neutral tax reform, which the reason for that is the big benefit of a revenue-neutral tax reform plan is that it will allow tax changes to be permanent rather than having a 10-year expiration, which is what the last tax cut bill in 2003 did. It did expire in 2013. So everyone would obviously be much more much happier with a permanent tax cut. However, the name revenue neutrality does not necessarily place Congress in a strict straitjacket in terms of being able to create some stimulus in a fiscal plan. There are some loopholes that can be that are in place that can be taken advantage of, which would allow, we think, a pro-growth tax cut, even with that revenue-neutral label. This is important because there are deductions and credits that would otherwise have to be disbanded, and those would be politically infeasible to do. Obviously, nobody would like to see their, for example, a home mortgage deduction reduced or cut or eliminated. That would be extremely difficult. Not many congressmen would vote for that. So those things are obviously much better to avoid. The way Congress can go about getting revenue neutrality and yet have a tax cut along with it is first to introduce dynamic scoring of a tax bill. I know we introduced that concept within one of the last few calls, and currently the Senate does not allow dynamic scoring, which is, you know, pretty antiquated of them, but from what we hear, they're going to take up the issue of dynamic scoring in the fourth quarter of this year, which would be a precursor to them considering this strategy that I'm describing here. So if they're able to use dynamic scoring of a tax bill, they could actually be able to recognize a revenue increase that would come from this pro-growth stimulus, which would make it a lot more liberal as to how they structure this bill. Because, in fact, is you think about it, if you get a tax cut, you probably are going to end up spending some of that money, which would stimulate the economy in itself, and it creates tax revenue. So dynamic score is just basically recognizing how people actually behave when they get a tax cut. The second thing that Congress can do is they can instruct the Congressional Budget Office that they are to change the revenue baseline assumed as terms of what the status quo is, to assume that any temporary tax cuts that are now in place are actually going to be permanent. And that basically creates a lot more liberal standard for setting the baseline, which again gives the Congress more room to maneuver with this revenue neutrality aspect of the budget reconciliation. When you put those two things together, the dynamic scoring and changing the revenue baseline to a policy baseline rather than what the law actually says, we believe that there could be as much as $1 trillion of tax reform, which would allow them to introduce a tax cut without having to do offsetting credits and deduction losses by the public. So the good news here, we think, is that a tax cut with tax reform can actually happen. It probably will not happen this year. It will probably happen in early 2018. That is partially to do because of the delays that have been caused by the continuing struggle over the repeal and replacement of the ACA or Obamacare. That has put Congress behind in its schedule. But if it can be done in 2018, early in the year, retroactive to early to the beginning of 2018, with the stimulus package in it, we think this will be a significant benefit to the economy. We think it'll be a surprise to investors who are not hearing about this now. So we will keep you up to date on this, but look forward to discussion about this in the future in the news, but probably not immediately. We think this conversation will probably start out in September and beyond, but there's potentially good news out there on the front of tax reform and tax cuts. So wanted to leave you with that. I don't see any questions in the queue, so we'll wrap it up for this month, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in August. Thank you very much.